Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with all those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, the producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, editors, production designers, costume designers, sound mixers, sound editors, VFX gurus, some of my faves, sound, composers. I just talk to them all, and we talk to them all here on Behind the Lens. We're going to do a lot of talking today. We got a full house. Already on hold. They're there, Pam? Okay. Well, already on hold, we have our first two guests, live guests today, Chris Carter and Jessica Morgan, the co-writers, co-directors of Halloween film. Get ready, people. We're getting dark a little bit early this year. Night of the Harvest. And it is a true Halloween party, Halloween night film. I think you're going to like it, and I'm looking forward to speaking with Chris and Jessica. Chris is also the cinematographer on Night of the Harvest. But then later in the show, also joining us live will be writer-director Daniel Hanna talking about his new film, Succubus. And if that doesn't scream darkness, I don't know what does. Really looking forward to speaking with Daniel. You've heard me talk in the past about the film Supercell, the tornado film. He was the editor on that. Just 2 weeks ago, we had Anna Elizabeth James on talking about Held Hostage in My House, her Lifetime thriller that she directed. And we talked about Daniel and his work. He's the editor on Held Hostage in My House. So everything kind of, we've got less than 6 degrees of separation going on here at Behind the Lens. But now, and before I bring on Chris and Jessica, I just have to say, anybody else watch the series finale of Snowpiercer last night? It was sweet, a little lackluster for my taste, but the final shot of the entire series was absolutely beautiful. And I know it was CGI'd, but it was beautiful. And I do want to give a shout out to my friend, my good friend, John Corcoran, who was, he was one of the two writers on episode, was it 8? And he was in the writer's room for the entire last season, and I think part of the season before. So job well done to the entire writing team, although I would have liked a little more pizzazz with a series finale to something like Snowpiercer. But if you haven't seen it, check it out. If you've watched the series at all, I think you will at least appreciate that. And talk about appreciating. Monster. The Lyle and Eric Menendez story on Netflix. Oh my God. Once you start, you will binge all 9 episodes. Huge, huge, huge shout out for the performances, which are absolutely amazing. Amazing. We're going to talk more about Monster, I think, next week. But right now, I'm bringing them on. Chris Carter and Jessica Morgan. Hi, guys.
Hi there.
I am so happy to have you. Really kicking off Halloween a little bit early this year.
Oh, yes. We do that.
With Night of the Harvest. This is, as I said at the opening, this is a Halloween movie. A bloody Halloween horror film that takes place on Halloween. This is so much fun. You've crafted a really interesting story. You've got the climax and the reveals in Act 3. I did not even expect the ultimate reveal That was a huge shock and surprise to me.
Thank you, Seth. That's awesome.
So, generally, I can figure them out, especially a film like this, before we get that far. But, no, you populate this film. You've got some great production design, designing where the crux of this Halloween party is supposedly going to take place. It's been decorated. It's creepy. It's got an attic-y feel to it. And then you've got some engaging characters who pop up. So I've got to ask the two of you, where did this whole story start with? I know the credits are giving you credit, Jessica, for coming up with the story. And then Chris had to come up with words and make it into a film.
Yeah, we definitely worked together on the story for sure. And I think we both came at it from different point of views. For me, I love Halloween. I'm about it. And so I was excited to make a film starting there. I think Chris was the one who got really into the old time Halloween. Is that right, Chris?
Yeah, I think when we started to write it, we really wanted to take what Halloween was and when it was scary. And, you know, the connotation of Halloween has just become so commercialized and, you know, costumes and candy and parties. And, you know, it's a very, like, it's a party holiday, but it didn't all start that way. And that's where we wanted to kind of begin our lore and our story, where Halloween wasn't that, where it was terrifying and it was something to be afraid of. And so we wanted to kind of begin there and then build outwards with the holiday of Samhain and some of the lore surrounding that.
Yeah, I mean, I love the way you have structured this. So it makes sense, but you you know, to see how things play out. But the way this opens, the film opens, and it's so sweet, and it's so nice, and we have a couple walking through a cornfield. Of course, anytime you're walking through a cornfield, you know it is not going to end well. I don't care what movie, I don't care what you're doing. If you're walking through a cornfield, you know when you see that, it is not going to end well. And it does not. And then we jump forward in time. So this might have been like the prior Halloween where we had the nice, sweet couple. And then we see the woman. And she's now looking miserable. And she's with her sister, Audrey. And Audrey is pushing her to get into the spirit. I got a shirt for you. Yeah, an orange shirt with just pumpkin eyes and a nose on it. Okay. Target appreciated that purchase, I'm sure. Oh, she looks so, so miserable. But then she's in a bar. It's like by herself. And a guy starts talking to her. And he's very nice. He's very friendly. We've met him. He's got a bestie. They're supposed to be going to a Halloween party. And the only person that is looking dour. Now, is it Madison or Riley? Audrey's sister, the miserable one. Madison or Riley?
That's actually going to be Jessica's character. So, yeah.
Because Jessica, you're Audrey.
Yeah. I think actually she dropped off, too. I might have to have her call back in and bring her back on. They're having phone troubles where they're at. But, no, yeah, Jessica is playing Audrey. And so it is about trauma. There is something to be said about that, too, where – you know, Jessica and I are both the oldest of siblings. And so there's a level of responsibility that character had to have. And also a huge moment of failure when, you know, you mentioned the cornfield and what happened to Brittany's character, Madison, and because she couldn't protect her younger sister. There's a lot of that going on. And more so than just trying to get her to go to a party, it was trying to get her sister back to being her sister, not like a shell of a person because of that specific trauma that she had gone through.
And you're really feeling for Madison. And I love what Brittany brings to the character, because when we first meet her, she's happy. She's hopeful. Then we see her miserable. and very a shell of a human being, really. She has not gotten over the trauma. And as our story progresses, she still, there's something not quite right. She really hasn't gotten over it. And no matter Audrey's best prodding, it's just not turning, that frown is not turning upside down. It's a very interesting sibling dynamic there that we're watching.
And that was a big deal. I definitely wanted to, because again, I'm a brother to a younger brother, and it's important. And also on Brittany's side too, because she wants to be okay. But where do you find your state of balance and getting back to where you think you should be after that event? So we have this conflict between these two sisters, and they're just trying to find a common ground. And of course, they unfortunately do have that common ground, and we'll get to it in a little bit. But
yes,
but yeah, we really wanted to kind of hone in on that.
And you do a really good job in the story construct with that, Chris. And of course, that is really aided by Jessica's performance and Brittany's performance.
Absolutely.
Hey, Pam?
Yeah, damn.
I think that Jessica's called in on the second line.
Okay, perfect.
Let's see what we're doing. Is that Jessica? Pam's working the phones.
Perfect.
Oh. It's not Jessica. It's a something. Who knows what it is? Nope, it's not Jessica. It was a wrong number.
Okay.
All right. Jessica and Brittany did a beautiful job in establishing that, and even the sisterly dynamic.
Yeah,
which that's
I loved
even
what they brought to it.
Yeah.
And I should say that Brittany and Jessica are actually very good friends outside of the film. We've done two films with Brittany together. I don't think that Jessica and Brittany have had a scene, and they're definitely the dynamic in this film is much different than anything we've done before. But yeah, and it was no one was going to believe and root for these girls. And again, that twist. Unless you cared for them as characters.
Yeah.
And that's just a credit to the actors really putting the time in and meeting. And I should say Brittany also has siblings as well. I believe she is the oldest, I think. So there is that common bond and denominator between these two women who are fabulous actors,
mm-hmm.
who just kind of found that. And I really believe that you believe them when they go through this trauma, and anybody that has a sibling or even a really good friend who they consider a sibling might identify with the two women in this film. Absolutely.
And that you really need that to be established to believe what happens in Act 2 and 3. You have to have that believability, that resonance there. But also, you need to understand their connection when we have the rest of the cast popping in here, especially, you know, I got to tell you, the characters of Dane and William are fabulous. Fabulous.
Thank you so much. They're going to love hearing that.
Jim Cerner is Dane. Eric Azana is William. They are to die for. They really add humor and lightness, which is what you'd expect on Halloween at a party.
Yeah. And so there's so much of, and Jessica would say this, and as one of the primary writer of the film, no matter what, some of you is going to come across in all of the characters.
Right.
I think a lot of me comes out in Dane, or that's what Jessica would say. She's told me that multiple times. And so the way Jim portrays that is just so funny and silly, but so serious and dedicated to his friend. And funny story, Eric and Jim have only been on one other project, but not worked together. And when we first casted them, I had my doubts about that because the camaraderie that these two characters needed to have, obviously you had to care about them. You had to care about them just as much as you cared about Brittany and Jessica's characters, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And so you know, they would hang out. But funny enough, the first time that they actually were on screen together is during that walk-in talk when they're talking about the Halloween costume. And we had the actors mic'd, or we had them lapped because they were moving and we couldn't boom them. And so they were talking, that we caught them on the back end. They were talking about comic books and football. And from there, it turns out that the blossomed friendship where, you know, they seem to be inseparable in some cases, even to this day. So it was a really cool forming of something that transcended not just this movie, but the individual themselves. And of course, that just made the movie so much better with what they did with those characters.
And I think we have Jessica back now. Are you there, Jessica?
And I apologize. I think it's cutting out a bunch still. You may have to continue without me. I'm so sorry. I think I'm having bad issues over here.
Where are you?
Why am I lost? She's in LA right now. So maybe in the area there's having a specific issue with the phone lines. I apologize for that.
Oh, no. Trust me. There's only one seat in my entire house where I can get a cell signal, which is why I have a hardwired landline.
Oh, perfect.
I will fight for that hardwired landline till the day I die. Because there, so
yes.
I understand, because there is only one spot in my entire condo where my cell phone, well, I can text, but cannot talk. It cuts out. So, yeah. So I understand completely. But we still have you, Chris.
Hopefully, I'll have to do enough for the both of us. But I think I can.
I think you can, yeah. Especially since, you know, you're writer, director, and cinematographer. Now, did you always know that you were going to be the DP on this one? That was always your intent?
And that's something I take great pride in that. Like, my degree is in creative writing, but also a focus with journalism. And I loved to do documentaries. And so that just kind of had this natural evolution into camera and lighting. And then I just started to make movies. I love being a DP and cinematographer. I love the idea of playing with lights and shadows. And to be honest with you, that's why I just kind of resonate with the Halloween space in terms of filmmaking.
Oh, sure. Because,
like you mentioned, exactly. You know, you've got green lights and orange lights and purple. The motivation for the way that you can light these scenes, you know, I tell people we're creating pools of light, but a sea of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so fun to play with, and it creates these emotions. And granted, you know, we really kind of help the actors to kind of elicit that sense of fear by putting them in these situations where as soon as our people walk on set, they're a little uncomfortable because of the environment, the lighting. It just adds to the performance. So, yeah, I love being a DP cinematographer, to be honest. Yeah, I love it.
Well,
I do.
Something that I really love is that your production design in creating this party spot, this haunted house-like party spot, the production design, I really like it. It lets you play with those pools of light and build them up while also giving you negative space, pockets of negative space.
Yeah.
That a negative space is something I love when a filmmaker knows how to use it, because that can scare the bejeebus out of you. Not knowing what is there in the dark, and depending on your colorist and what you're doing, you can get levels of black, levels of blue-black inkiness in there that make you think you're seeing something that you might not be seeing. So I always love it when I see a filmmaker such as yourself who knows how to play with that and make it work to your advantage. And you do that here, especially with the more claustrophobic nature of this haunted house. We're walking up narrow corridors. And, of course, I'm thinking about, oh, my God, what cameras is he using? Because there's no room to navigate. You're basically, you're either going to do a handheld and walk backwards, or you might put something on sticks, but then you're going to have to change that up really quickly. So talk to me about your labor-intensive visual grammar in terms of your logistics?
I love that question. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. So I'm obviously a camera guy. I love the nerdy part of it. I get really excited about that. And I start talking to people and their eyes start to glass over. It's an independent film. Jessica and I funded this entire film ourselves. So in that process, I'm sure you speak to a bunch of filmmakers in that stance where you have to wear several hats. I was the DP, the writer, co-director, editor, colorist. Like, all of the post work was something that I kind of shouldered. So having that unfortunate but also fortunate burden where I knew exactly how I was going to grade it. So when you're looking at in the scopes, when you talk about the negative space, I understood that it's okay to underexpose a little bit here because I know I'm going to pop something in there in post, or I'm going to go ahead and overexpose here and I'm going to drop this in post so that I can hide a reveal of someone coming out. And being intimately involved with also the lighting scheme, all of those things, it's this weird concert that it's a lot of stuff to hold in your head as you go.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like knowing the end of the game before the game's even started. You know how you want it to look, and you can do everything in the middle of the way to make sure that happens. And for me, you brought the camera up. We used the Red Komodo, the original one.
Oh, nice.
And, and to me, this is the first entire feature we've shot with on the Red platform.
Mm-hmm.
We shot everything in 6K HQ using the Red codec. And that to me was game changing. And I'm not a Red fanboy. I want to go on the record saying that. This is like I said, I generally can't afford the $20,000 Monstros or whatever.
Sure.
But getting a Red and having the Red codec allowed us to shoot some things that we would never have been able to do with the base ISO for us of 800. And in that scene specifically you're talking about, we used some LED lights for the party scene, and they were hung up on trusses.
Yeah.
An actual running haunted house, too. The slaughterhouse in Tucson was gracious enough to let us pre-light. Because that was a big deal too. We were we have a great relationship with the owners there, and it's in Tucson, so that was a complication as well. Everybody being local to LA, Jessica and I had to find a way to get them down to Tucson, whether we're flying them or organizing a carpool and where places where people have to stay too. But you know, it's that indie filmmaker hat you have to wear, and so we were able to pre-light, which was huge, right? Anybody that says that, obviously the production goes off so much smoother. We went in there the day before we filmed. We set all of our lights. And because so much of the blocking and the action happens in that specific scene, we tested it and we pre-lit that area. And we probably spent maybe 4 hours doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was so helpful because, like you said, the pockets of negativity in that scene in terms of lighting was so important. We couldn't overlight. We couldn't just blast, 4 4Ks or 4 6Ks going in there and just flood it with lights. That wasn't what our film was about. We didn't want it to look like that. So we had to flag a bunch of lights. We had to boom over some lights to make sure that some of our actors were keyed perfectly, even after they're blocking. And that took some time. But you had mentioned the labor of love when it comes to setting this stuff up. The pre-lighting that specific scene was huge for us.
It was absolutely
huge.
Oh, and, I can see that on screen. I could see where you had some of the LEDs, some of the colored ones, and you didn't go overkill either with those. You basically, by pre-lighting, you've essentially, quote-unquote, built them into your set.
Exactly, yeah.
And you did not go overkill. You could have put them, they looked like they were probably, 4 inches apart, Each one of those lights that were up on the trusses, they looked like they were probably 4 inches apart. You didn't go for the overkill of half an inch between each one, because even with a colored light, with a colored orange, that would cast too much light, I think, on the actors. And it would destroy the spookiness and
you're absolutely right.
The fear. So I love what you how you did that. And I'm glad that you had the chance and the opportunity to pre-light so you could take your time and do that. because it really works to your advantage in this film.
I appreciate you noting that too, but you're absolutely right. And honestly, having a light board, we use aperture lights, but mm-hmm. not just them. So we have the ability to kind of put them on a light board on an iPad so we can bring them up and down, change colors. But yeah, that was very, very intentional. So I appreciate the note on that. So it's nice to know that somebody appreciates that.
I am a diehard for cinematography and how you use and how light and lens and shadow tell a story. That's one of the reasons I think, as a rule, I typically much prefer black and white films and the grayscales of back from the golden age of Hollywood in the 30s, the 40s. Could be because the very first film I ever saw when I was 4 years old was Nosferatu. Murnau's Nosferatu.
That's incredible.
Yeah. My dad, my grandfather liked it. So indoctrinate me really early at four. It could be one reason why I like horror and why I like dark noir films so much. But you look at the lighting in films like that and it just makes the entire film. Even an early Hitchcock Silent of the Lodger that he did when he was still in Britain. It's all reddish, but it's red with some negative space tossed in there. So when I see something that looks really good, really thought out, like what you've done here, I so appreciate it, Chris. So appreciate it.
That makes me smile from ear to ear, honestly, because there's one thing I tell everybody that when we make a movie, I'm like, hey, I'll make it look good. Because I take it so personal to make sure that our film looks good and our actors look good and whatnot. And to hear you say that makes my cinematography heart beam. So I really appreciate you saying that, Debbie. Thank you so much.
You know, and one of the beautiful things, too, because of the hardwood, the wood floor, the wood, and the way you have the lighting, when we get to a lot of the blood-drenched scenes that happen in this one particular area, there's a lot of bloodshed happening in this one area. So, but I love the color. It's not bright red. It's that dark, dirty, dark brown, brownish red. And it looks so fantastic, and it feeds into the idea of the evil that is spewing about on Halloween.
You know, I love that you say that or caught that, because that was something definitely we did because of that. We really tried to stay away from, as the movie goes on, and Jessica would say this better than I could, but we intentionally made it darker. So obviously it starts very traditional, very happy, very Halloween. Yeah. As it gets towards the end, it becomes more ritualistic. And the color palette definitely, where we wanted the color palette to reflect that. The lights get darker, the totems get bigger, mm-hmm. The shadows get deeper, and the blood gets darker. Because like you said, it is evil, it is dark. It's not something that should be bright or well lit. It's not something to celebrate in terms of the story. I understand as a horror movie, sure, we want that. But for what you feel for these characters, it's not something we want to celebrate. You know, it should be dark and evil and yeah. foreboding. And also, you feel bad. You know, there should be a level of, wow, that sucks, that happened to that character that we hope that you care so much for throughout the film.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. But yeah, I really appreciated that you did that, because we had all the lightness. The film got tonally darker. First, we have our nice, beautiful cornfield. Pam? I'm calling out to Pam because I think this is my next guest is calling in, and he'll be on hold for a little bit because we're still chatting. I do that every week to everybody. I don't like cutting off I don't like cutting off my filmmakers. I don't like cutting off my filmmakers. You know, most places they'll give you 5 minutes tops. I like giving you 30, if not more.
I love it. Thank you so much.
But you know, in that, now I forget, you start out tonally very light in our cornfield. It's bright, it's beautiful, nice, the beautiful green leaves on the corn stalks. And then we slowly start getting a little darker. We get a little darker when we meet Madison, when she's sitting there being very morose and Audrey's trying to talk her into cheering up and putting her in an orange Target Halloween shirt. And then we go to the bar and it's dark woods in there and it's not very light and bright. But in between there, you've edited in there Joyce, who is essentially comic relief.
Right.
And she's light and bright and spunky and perky, and something happens with her. And then things really start to tonally get darker. And then we get, as night falls and as we get to the haunted house, then things really take a dark tone. And I like the progression. I like how you have developed that through performance, through your production design, but mainly through your cinematography and your lighting. Just so well done, Chris. So well done.
Thank you so much. I can't say thank you enough. That really makes me smile. I appreciate it. And that Joyce scene that you're talking about, you're absolutely right. That character was kind of supposed to embody how people see Halloween today. It's about partying and let's get everybody together and, you know, let's watch a movie in a graveyard. It's like, well, okay, that's true. But before that, it was something to be very terrified of. And so I think that, that's definitely something we wanted to convey. And also that when Joyce goes to the house, to the mountain house, we really wanted to pull in that specific scene, 80s Carpenter vibes, where we had blue tinted lights kind of punching through the sheets and windows, and we used that to kind of cue her along with, a happy Halloween sign. So it's very 80s moonlight, right? Punching through, you've got four windows punching through blue lights and whatnot. And we did that. And also when they go into the basement too, very kind of carpentry. And I think that's really where I kind of wanted to use some 80s lighting for that part of it, just to kind of give a nice little nod to, of course, you know, John Carpenter, who kind of started this whole thing off. But Season of the Witch, which doesn't get a lot of love. It does now, right?
Before, it didn't used to.
Hated. Yeah.
It
right?
didn't like, used to.
It did. It did. And I just love how people have kind of embraced it now. And a lot of our story was kind of motivated by some parts in that film, but that lighting was really, really cool. And we just wanted to kind of give a throw out to that. But I really appreciate the compliment on the cinematography. I take so much time and love and put so much thought into that. And I mean, probably 2 weeks before we film, I'm thinking about how we're going to light it, how we're going to move the camera, where our shadow is going to be, what our primary is going to be, how is the actor going to stand, where's the eye light going to come from, like all of these things that cinematographers think about. But just for you to take the time to notice it, it's really really great. We appreciate that big time.
And of course, in addition to that, you're also thinking about your shooting as a director. You're thinking about your shooting schedule. You're thinking about directing your talent, which I'm sure is where Jessica comes in very handy, because she's a co-director on this. She's also the quote-unquote lead actor, so to speak. She's there interacting with the actors, which frees you up to a degree to focus on the technical aspect. But
that, you're absolutely right. And I don't think I could make this movie without Jessica. And because of what you said, again, independent filmmakers, we have to wear so many hats.
Yep.
We can't just be like, hey, reach out to our production design lead or reach out to our cinematography lead. We are those people. So, you know, Jessica traditionally will work with the actors, kind of getting them to where we need them to be. And then I'll work through cinematography, lighting, blocking, and then we kind of come together. I've been very fortunate to work with Jessica, and she's been so fantastic to any production that she's on. And I don't think I can make a film without her at this point. we started principal photography on our newest film last Friday, and
oh, wow.
There's a moment. If it yeah, we're in a cornfield again, and there's a moment where we have to run up flags, and we have to do makeup, and I'm running camera, and we have to cover the actors to make sure they're not getting too hot, and, you know, all of this stuff. And to have to be an independent director doing that would be, I don't know how they could, but because I have Jessica and we have each other, we split that, and it just seems to work out very, very well. So yeah, it is a huge, huge help to have a co-director in the space that we're trying to make films in. Absolutely.
Well, yeah. Unfortunately, I do have to bid you goodbye so that I can bring Daniel Hanna in to talk about his creepy film, Succubus. But, Chris, I you have to come back on the show. Even if it is just to talk about production elements and cinematography, I've got to have you back on the show at some point. But in the meantime, everybody can see Night of the Harvest tomorrow. It's out on digital.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. And Debbie, I will take you up on that. I would love to talk production, lighting, camera, all that stuff. The props, we haven't even talked about the props, and those are so instrumental in that. And
yeah.
Yeah, anytime, I would love to be back. Just let me know. I'll be back same day.
I will tell Karen that we need to make this happen.
Okay. Thank you so much,
Chris.
Okay, I appreciate the call.
Thank you. And please tell Jessica we love her work. Sorry, your phone's not working.
I'll be sure to tell her that. I will.
Oh, thanks so much, Chris. You go have a great rest of your week.
Thanks, Debbie. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Chris Carter. And we tried to have his co-director, Jessica Morgan, in there, but her phones weren't working. It's not a problem with ours for a change. All right, now. But you can see Night of the Harvest tomorrow on digital. And it's going to be a fun one for you. If you like Halloween, if you like horror, see it. Now, I'm so thrilled to have this man joining me, Daniel Hanna. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
I am thrilled. I am such a big fan of your work. Your editing on Supercell. Anna James was just on the show a couple weeks ago when we were talking about Held Hostage in My House. And you were a big part of the conversation with your editing there. And now, here you are with Succubus. Wow. I am so impressed with this film. What really attracted me the minute I started watching the film is you utilized a lot of what Timur Bekmambetov originated and started and called screen life, where everything is the platform, everything is done on a computer screen, on a cell phone, FaceTiming, but it's all done on screens. Thus, the term screen life. And it works so well because you take that premise with Succubus and you take it, it's not just looking at screens and exchanging and communicating through the screens. In essence, we're metaphorically going through the screens. And it is so original, so cool, and then your visuals that bring it to life, fantastic. So well done. I love this film.
Wow, thank you so much.
I love this film, Daniel. Love this film.
That's incredible. That's incredible to hear, truly, because you get in a, you know, you get down in your little kind of editing hole for a long time. Especially something like this with all these VFX. And it's just great to be able to share it with people and have them see it and experience it all at once in like 100 minutes, you know, instead of across a year.
Yeah. But the way you have integrated everything and the story, the story is it's an essentially simple story. You've got our new dad, Chris. He's already separated from his wife. They've got issues. He can't really handle, and he's watching the baby while she's out at a bachelorette party. So he's got all kinds of things happening in his brain to begin with. And then thanks to his best friend, Eddie, somehow signs himself up for a dating app. Not really a smart thing to do as a new father when you think you might get back together with your wife, even though you're separated now. But hey,
right.
let's listen to BFF Eddie, who's divorced and whose ex-wife is your wife's best friend. Yeah, not a lot of brain cells firing on this one with Eddie and Chris. But then, as would happen, he starts swiping right and not left. And finally, somebody else swipes right. Actually, two people swipe right. And it's the second one that's when things really get interesting and weird and mysterious. And this just takes off. Where did you even come up with the idea for this, Daniel?
So it's funny because originally it did come from, I'd gotten out of a long-term relationship, and for the first time, you know, I'd never been on dating apps or anything like that. And the very, you know, when I got on them, this was several years ago, and it was like, there were all these kind of bots and people kind of fishing, and you started to have this experience like, oh, am I actually really talking to a person? Or is this some kind of, even back then, some kind of AI? Or is it somebody, you know, in some far-off land who's trying to scam me? And it just created a little kind of sinister seed in my head. And years later, just sat down and thought, you know, I should try and write this. And I thought I had all these kind of crazy ideas for it. And I sat down and I thought, oh, I could maybe write something that takes place a little bit through the screen for at least part of the movie, because that is how we deal with this stuff. And, and when you're on, you know, when you're looking to meet people, or, you know, if you're involved in some intense text exchange with somebody, like those little dots that pop up and images that come in can really be just as strange and intriguing and interesting as real life. And that for me was something I thought was interesting, because more and more, I feel like we are getting sucked into our phones and technology and screens. And this movie was a little bit like, okay, what happens if you get involved with something sinister and dangerous in your screen life, and then you leave that screen life, and it kind of comes with you?
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of the idea.
Yeah, that's one of the great things, where you actually meld screen life with real life. And it actually gets to the point with what's happening that in the third act, you're actually wondering, is this real? Is it live or is it Memorex? Just so well structured. And you really make us think in this film. Not only are we, we're right in there with Chris. You believe him, you feel for him, and you understand, because as you said, the very nature of everybody getting sucked into all of these devices and their screens, you believe that he is just spellbound by this woman that he sees, with the tantalizing moments and tidbits that she's feeding him visually. But then when reality inserts itself at certain moments, when he inadvertently answers his phone and it's his mother while he's doing something he shouldn't be doing, in the bed next to where his baby is in a crib. So you have these moments where things start intersecting and bring him back into reality, so to speak. And Rosanna Arquette sells that beautifully as Chris's mom, Denise.
She's so funny.
She is hilarious. Hilarious. And her face is like, oh my God. Oh my God. Are you really doing that? And your baby is right there. Oh my God. What is wrong with you? And you can just envision any mother saying that to their grown son. I'm not even going to ask if that happened to you.
I'll go ahead and tell you it did not, just so we're clear.
Well, thank God. But through this, you really start pulling us in with the cinematography. Jimmy Liu's cinematography, he's so good. I know his work. He was not only did one of his early shorts, he was a DP for Ryan Coogler on one of Coogler's first shorts, Fig. But Jimmy was also the DP for my friend Ian Michaels and his wife Sarah Smick on their film, Friended to Death.
Oh, great. Yeah, yeah.
So I know Jimmy's work. And I love what you and Jimmy have designed with your visual grammar here. So I'm really curious about your conversations with Jimmy and developing the visual tonal bandwidth through the visual grammar and the negative space. And really, you're playing with focal length, some very dioptric elements here, color. All of this just melds so beautifully. So I'm curious what you and Jimmy were plotting and planning with this one.
Yeah, we planned a lot. I mean, you know, because it is a movie that one, you know, part of it, probably maybe a third of the movie or a fourth of the movie is shot, you know, via screens and cell phones and things like that, so that you're living in the screen life, like you said. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, the rest of it isn't. And they had to, for us, be pretty separate and different and have a different feel. Mm-hmm. But then we did want to start to try and blend them together in the sense where it would begin to initially feel like you're really just experiencing like what a screen is like. And then as you leave that and you enter the cinematic world or the real world and he's getting back on the screen, it starts to then take on more of a cinematic vibe.
Very much
not necessarily
so.
In the way it's like lit or shot, but in the way, you know, it just progresses and it's edited. And when we're going back and forth between the two worlds, and it was a whole big part of just it developing and establishing contrast. And then in the real world, developing contrast between the sort of supernatural, other world and real life. So that those two were, you know, one is very red and orange and kind of hellish, and the other is kind of cold and blue and kind of night, you know, because they're kind of isolated out there. And we talked endlessly about this stuff. And kind of what we did early on was kind of show people what would happen in the movie by we start with Ron Perlman and we start in his phone and then we leave his phone. And to kind of show people, here's how this movie's going to work. It's going to play in these two different worlds, and you're going to have a different perspective, hopefully, depending on which you're seeing it through.
You know, and you bring up Ron, who I think is wonderful here, is Dr. Zephyr. I think Ron is wonderful in anything. But I love how when we're meeting him and he's in his car and he's going hands-free with his phone, very responsible of you there. He's hands-free. He's got the phone mounted on the dash. But I did have to laugh at one point. He's going, wait a minute here, wait a minute here. And he has to try and adjust the phone. He's going, I have astigmatism. I can't. And it's just so human and it's so funny. So it really, it breaks some tension that you really needed to be broken. So that it kind of, so that whatever Zephyr has to say to Chris, it's kind of starting off on a clean slate. Because Chris has not been that convinced about Zephyr and thinks he's weird.
Right.
So I like that. But that has a whole different tone. You go more when you've got Zephyr on his cell phone. He actually, he's more of the blue, more of the blue washout. In the cinematic, in the real world, versus the screen life, even though he is on a screen. So I really like how you did that. Really like how you did that.
Oh, thank you. I mean, Jimmy's incredible, too. I mean, obviously, we talk endlessly and endlessly for so long because, you know, indie movies are tough to make, and if you have a little extra time, you might as well get your DP, you know, working with you on it.
Yeah. What were you guys shooting this one on?
Shooting it on?
Yeah. Okay. Well.
So we shot on the Alexa for all the cinematic stuff, and then we were shooting it all on iPhone, I think iPhone 14s. So all the computer stuff, all that, we shot on the iPhone. And honestly, we even worried that it was going to look too good because we wanted to have a contrast, and we'd look at it and go, wow, it almost looks too good. Like it almost is, not that it's the same as an Alexa, but, you know, it's...
It looks good.
You forget. Yeah, you forget.
Now, you know, you were working with Brian and Noam on your editing here. Really, how long was the editing process? How challenging was this? Because especially with your screen life visuals, because you're going back and forth and back and forth. So I'm curious about that, because also notable is that when Chris is on the cell phone with his wife, with Sharon, that we've got totally beautiful colors, you know, skin tone is natural, nice lighting at the party scene that she's at. So that's a whole other look that you have happening here too. So I'm curious about the editing and blending all of this together.
Definitely a very complicated editing process for this movie, because we had to blend these two worlds. We had to figure out how do you pace things that are in the screen life versus pace things that are in the real world. And I was really fortunate to be working with these two editors. We edit together. Brian and I have edited together before, and we have a company now, Time Weaver, that's an editorial company. So it was like such a good process that we basically decided, okay, we should continue to work together as like a unit if we can, because we kind of all had different sensibilities and took different passes at each part of the, you know, the edit and the story. And really what it was about was trying to find the best way, as always, just to tell the story through, you know, through whether it's through a screen or whether through mm-hmm. a more conventional shooting technique. You know, for instance, like that scene you mentioned where he's on the FaceTime with his wife, you know, Noam did the initial cut of that scene, and he made them a two shot the way it is, where you're seeing both mm-hmm. the screens at the same time. And I wasn't totally convinced on the timing on some things, or I worried, you know, maybe we're not going to connect to them as much if it's a two shot rather than cutting back and forth to a closer shot. And so then I did a different cut where I cut it more conventionally, where you cut back and forth between the two screens. And then ultimately we decided that what Noam had done initially was going to work better. We just had to work on it more, because mm-hmm. you get to see and live in both of them and see both of their reactions and kind of see more of a bond between them in a two shot.
Yeah.
Even though it's not a real two shot because they're in different locations. And things like that were just a really interesting, you know, part of the process that you couldn't really have on another movie. Like, I guess in theory, you could say, let's just hold on this master for one take in a movie. And sometimes that's great and the right way to do it. But it's rare. It's rare to kind of be able to really choose to kind of make your own master, because you're doing it through two different phones and two different locations. And so kind of every decision really compounded, like every part of the process had more and more and more decisions that we had to make. And then especially when you get into the really, really crazy stuff in the movie,
yeah,
you're trying to balance pace while also kind of showing everything that you need to show, keep it moving fast, but people have to understand it. And it is a pretty unique situation that he gets into. And so we want people to literally be able to understand what is happening in his world without bogging them down too much. And all of that kind of stuff. And hypnosis was something we really thought about too, in the editing of this movie. When do we want to kind of lure people into a, you know, kind of a calmer, but maybe still tense state in some of these moments. Mm-hmm. Versus going fast and jumping out and keeping it more action oriented. And so just everything was it was kind of always pulling it tight and then letting it get loose and just finding where's the place where it clicks into gear and it kind of is like a roller coaster, and you have the slow rises at times, and then you have the fast mm-hmm. drops, and then the rises again. And that was really fun to explore and fill out.
Well, I have to ask you about your visual effects, and of course, the look of, you know, obviously we have a succubus. A succubus mm-hmm. looks quite interesting. Mm-hmm. Was this makeup or was it visual effects? Because that is one incredible look.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, it was mostly, I mean, when it's full makeup, it's makeup.
Wow.
And when you're in sort of, there's a part in the middle of the movie, and I don't ever really want to spoil things, obviously.
Yeah, we don't want to spoil.
But there's a part where you kind of, you're getting a bit of a look via a secondary character at her, but she's very silhouetted and obscured.
Yes.
And in those moments, the VFX is really about combining the whole world together. We had a great VFX supervisor, Lincoln Smith, who did so many things that you would never even know are in the movie. But yeah, it was very much about trying to always find a way to obscure her until really the very, very end, where we're going to see everything.
But that the makeup is just, the full makeup is just absolutely stunning. Stunning.
Yes, I mean, totally. Like, Tate, our makeup supervisor, and I, you know, he would send me these kind of drawings and all this stuff, and, you know, I kind of had a bunch of references, and we would go back and forth. And it was interesting to find, because obviously Rachel's like a very like stunningly beautiful woman.
Yes.
And so then we're going to put her in all this makeup too, but you still want her to come through, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's finding that balance between, well, she has to be terrifying, you know, and she has to really creep you out when you see her. And you have to believe that, which is very hard in the application of it too, you know? But at the same time, you want some of her to come through, and a sense of, like, she's still that character that you've been relating to, you know, this whole time.
And that really comes through with her eyes. You get some great, Jimmy gives you some great shots, you know, full frontal. So we see her eyes, which are obscured initially in the film.
Yes.
In the film. But that's our connection there. You know, the eyes are the windows to the soul. Chris, I don't know if this is a soul we really want to be looking into. But the eyes, you can tell it's her. So you do retain that element there. But that makeup, just outstanding, Daniel. Outstanding.
Oh, I'm so glad.
And that leads to a really great shot you have in the Red World. That's backlit, and all you have, you've got the black silhouette, with the horns rising up.
Mm-hmm.
You know the scene I'm talking about?
Oh, I do.
Yes. Absolutely gorgeous. I would have to say that's one of your money shots of the film.
Oh, I know.
In all honesty.
I mean, it was crazy doing, you know, we're shooting this stuff on green screen, you know, obviously, and, you're looking and you're like, okay, I think this is going to work. I do think this is going to work. And then when it all comes together, it's like, okay, yeah, that really works. And some of the bummers with this movie was when it came time to cutting the trailer, like we really aren't putting into the trailer like most of our best shots.
You're not putting in much at all.
I know, because we don't want to like take away from the sort of initial reveals by showing it all there, but then you get, it's frustrating. It's like, oh, I wish we could just show this or show that and people could see the scope of the movie more, you know, because it's a movie that keeps growing and growing and growing as it goes. And I don't think anyone would ever expect where it's going to go when they first get on that ride early on.
Oh, and nobody is ever going to expect what we get in the final moments of the film.
Right.
You know, I kind of thought, okay, we're going to get the one. Not the way it plays out, but I thought, okay, you know, one of this is going to happen. But then to see how it actually played out, wow. And Rosanna Arquette helps make that final scene, I got to tell you.
Oh, yeah. and she was so great on set. I mean, she was someone who really, we had lunch before, you know, so many actors I only met on set, you know, but she and I had lunch before, and she really kind of got the themes, the underlying themes, uh-huh. and sort of saw what the deeper, you know, kind of beyond the movie, what the deeper themes were. And that was really cool. And, you know, on set, she was so good, so funny, but she's not playing it for humor, you know. And she asked me at one point, she said, she was like, am I doing this right? Because it's supposed to be kind of funny, right? Like, it's supposed to be a little funny. I was like, yeah, you're doing it. You're doing it exactly right. And she hit that tone perfectly of just the kind of WTF of what this movie is and where it goes.
Yeah. But I have to say, your cast on the whole, I mean, you've got Brendan who plays Chris. You've got Rosanna who plays Chris's mom, Denise. You know, Ron Perlman is just wonderful as Dr. Zephyr. And to see what he does, the man that we initially meet in the film is not who we see later on in Act 3.
Right.
So very interesting. And of course, you've got Rachel Cook as Audra, Olivia Grace Applegate as poor wife Sharon, Emily Kincaid as Charlize, who's better off without Eddie, brilliantly played by Derek Smith. He is just, he's a kick in the ass.
He really is. And he was, you know, we had a lot of really funny auditions, but he was the only one really where I felt like he just is this guy.
Yeah.
Not that Derek is him in real life, but he's not trying to be funny. He just is being himself, and this is who he is. And that was just so great.
And to see how Brendan and Derek play off of each other via a computer screen and a cell phone is just amazing. Amazing. Did you have them doing that in real time, or did you shoot one, then the other, and put it together in editing?
So it was kind of both, because Derek and Brendan were there the whole shoot.
Okay.
Because of the way Derek's scenes broke down. We shot him basically in the first week and the second and the last week. And Brendan was there the whole time, obviously, because he's just carrying the whole movie on his shoulders. But with that is they would work together, and you know, they would work with each other off, you know, in each other's scenes. So we had to shoot them separately. We actually toyed with shooting them at the same time, and we just couldn't make it quite work technically, because we were shooting on two houses that were on the same property, so it was almost feasible. But they actually lived together in Montana, so they were housed there together, and so they were actually like roommates there, and had only met once before shooting started, and now they actually are very, very close friends, because they kind of, you know, bonded through the process of pretending to be friends on the movie, which is just great to see.
Their chemistry is just amazing, but Derek is just hilarious as Eddie.
Yeah.
Hilarious. I just, you know, I love their chemistry, but I loved the lightness, because you give us this lightness, so we're not, so it's a great precursor to the tonal shift the film takes. So you plan that out so well, Daniel, just so well.
Wow, thank you.
You know, and everybody's going to get to see this tomorrow. It's out on digital and on DVD.
Yes, we have a DVD, and the DVD has some great, you actually get to see, there's a cool making of, because of such a chunk of the movie was shot on phones, and phones were used. Even when we're shooting cinematically, we're still usually shooting a phone element in the scene. And so when Jimmy and I were like, inadvertently, we were recording so many tests that we kind of inadvertently made like shot making of footage, you know? And so we cut it together to kind of show people the process of how we're talking through, how's this going to work with the phone? Does it go here? Does it go there? And you kind of get to see us put the movie together, you know, in our pre-production and plan it out, which I think for people that are really into movies or into how movies are made, that'll be pretty interesting, because it's just, you're just seeing it, you know, there's no real commentary on it. You get to just actually see the process come together.
I mean, that's reason enough for me to buy the DVD. That alone is reason enough for me to buy the DVD, just to see that. And to watch that being done, you really don't need commentary. If you have any inkling about or idea about filmmaking at all, just watching something unfold like that, it's going to be an eye-opener.
I really think so. And one more thing is when we were shooting with Ron Perlman in the car, we actually got pulled over by the state police in Montana because they hadn't been alerted that we were shooting. And so, you know, we had lights and stuff and we were pulling it, you know, it was getting pulled on a process trailer. And actually that whole thing is also documented. We were still rolling the cameras. So we got, you know, the interaction with the cops and everything. And it was just really absurd situation.
Now, did they let you go when they realized that it was Hellboy you had in the car?
Basically, yeah. Once they were kind of like, okay, well, I don't know if we want to mess with this guy. We know, we've seen like what Ron's capable of. So we're just going to back away and let these guys continue with what they're doing.
Well, now you know for future reference, just have Ron Perlman in your cast at all times. Have him with you. So anytime anything untoward happens, cops can say, oh, no, thank you. That's okay. Go on your merry way. That is your lesson learned with Succubus here, Danny.
That's a good life lesson.
Oh my God. So now at the end of the day, with this coming out tomorrow and everybody can see it, and I highly encourage them to do it and not just see it once, but hey, see it more than once. What did you learn as a filmmaker, about yourself as a filmmaker and a storyteller with this film, because of incorporating these different realms of cinematic life, screen life? What did you learn that you can take forward into future films?
You know, I think it's something that you do always are always reminded, especially when making indie films. But for me in this, it was just, don't try and let yourself be limited by your technology and what you have at your disposal, you know, because really at the end of the day, so much of it is about the story and about connecting and working with the actor and finding things with the actor, mm-hmm. you know? And so in the stuff that's on the phone, you know, it's so fluid and so easy to change and move and try new things. And it just kind of created this sense of like freedom. And I think it's just really easy. I think it's just really important to always remember that you don't want to let the like technology or gear or things like that get in between you and the actor, or in between you and the story you're trying to tell. Because when you take something and you pick a style or you find a style in post, you can really make almost anything cinematic. If you're you know, planning it in advance and thinking about it through, but also just pure endurance. You learn endurance every movie.
Well, job so well done, Daniel. I love this film. I'm actually going to watch it again just because there is so much nuance, visual nuance to this. And I'm such a huge fan of the screen life formatting and storytelling. So, and for you to blend it all together in one film for me, I get the best of both worlds. So,
that's amazing.
Daniel, I can't thank you enough. What do you have coming up in the future, be it as an editor or as a director? Anything you can talk about?
I've got a few projects that are kicking around now, and it's kind of a little horse race to see what goes through, but I have a thriller that's set in Arkansas that's kind of like a little Silence of the Lambs-esque, because I grew up in Arkansas. And Matthew Modine, who was in my first two movies, he and I have a Western that he actually wrote the first draft of, and I've been writing the second draft,
mm-hmm.
and that's something we're very excited about. And I've got one more, which is a zombie movie on Skid Row, and we're about to start trying to see about getting that produced. So a lot of things in the early stages, and it's I'm hoping could just jump from, you know, one to another. Who
yeah.
knows?
Well, I will be looking for them, and I hope that you'll come back on the show again in the future.
Absolutely.
Be it as a director, be it just for some editing work that you've done. Because as I said, I'm such a huge fan of your editing work. That's how I know you from, is your editing work.
That's so kind of you to say and to notice. A lot of people overlook the editors.
No, no, no. Without the editors, you don't have a story. The editor can kill your story and kill your film. People need to realize that and appreciate that. You got the writers, you got the editors. Editors can save.
I agree.
Editors can save a bad script, or they can tank a good one.
Mm-hmm.
So, Daniel, this has been so wonderful having you back on again, and I can't wait till we get to chat again in the future.
Me too. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Daniel. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
And that was Daniel Hanna, writer-director of Succubus. So, two creepy films. Little early. Get ready for Halloween. You can see them both starting tomorrow on digital. Night of the Harvest and Succubus. And, of course, Succubus you can pick up as a DVD, which, based on the extras that Daniel said are on there, I will do my best to get a copy to pick it up. You should, too. So, that is all the time we have today. Sorry we didn't get Jessica on for her entire time with Chris, but she had phone issues. Not us this time, amazingly. Next week, we're going to be talking about Treasure Tracker, a family adventure film in time for supernatural stuff and creepy crawly things in time for Halloween. So, until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.